It'll be lap 207, the longest Daytona 500 ever.
So it's the last lap of the 2020 Daytona 500, and I'm standing in victory lane. You can't really see the racetrack.
Ryan McGee covers NASCAR for ESPN.
So I'm actually watching on the television monitor.
White flag under green. Next flag will end the race, and Newman is there.
Here comes Ryan Newman. He's in the lead. He's got a chance to win, another Daytona 500.
Blaney to the outside, to the inside. Here comes Hamlin up the outside.
Wow.
Crash into the wall, into the air goes Newman.
Next thing I know, when I look out onto the racetrack, I don't see the checkered flag flying in the air. I see Ryan Newman's car flying in the air.
In a shower of sparks on his roof, Ryan Newman comes across the line for it and comes to rest.
And for a guy like me that's been around for a really long time, your muscle memory kicks in. All right, we're not just covering the Daytona 500. We're covering maybe a death at the Daytona 500.
The AMR safety team is there quickly to attend to Ryan Newman.
It was a moment I never wanted to relive. And I remember there was a young reporter, and she was crouched down behind a news van. Her hands were shaking, and she's trying to light a cigarette. And I was like, "You okay?" And she says to me, she goes, "Have you ever had to deal with this before?" And I said, "Yes, I used to deal with it all the time, but not in a long time."
When Ryan Newman crashed during the final lap of last year's Daytona 500, the entire NASCAR world held its breath, fearing the worst, and remembering what happened 19 years earlier, on the same lap of the same race, when the sport lost its greatest legend.
The three car down.
Oh!
Big trouble. Big wreck behind him.
His car, he and Earnhardt crashed together when he turns 3 and 4.
After the accident in turn 4 at the end of the Daytona 500, we've lost Dale Earnhardt.
Today, as NASCAR returns to Daytona this weekend, Ryan McGee tells us how the death of Dale Earnhardt in 2001 changed the sport forever and left a legacy that lives on in every car and every driver to this day. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Friday, February 12th. This is ESPN Daily. Ryan McGee, ESPN Daily's chief paint trading correspondent. Thank you for joining me, man.
That's me, man. When I started at ESPN a really, really long time ago and I had this accent, they were like, "Hey, you know about NASCAR, right?" I go, yes.
You do more than just know about NASCAR, Ryan. You have now reported and narrated a new film for E60, and it's called Intimidator, The Lasting Legacy of Dale Earnhardt. And I want to talk to you about it today because it's about a lot more than how transcendent Dale was on the track. It focuses on how he radically changed NASCAR's culture when it comes to safety. But before we get into that, I do want you to just kind of sketch out for us who Dale was for the uninitiated here and what made him such a towering figure in the NASCAR universe?
Well, and it's interesting because he's been gone 20 years. I mean, NASCAR has run more than 700 races without Dale Earnhardt. And so for those of us of a certain age, the idea of having to explain him and why he's such a big deal seems insane. But we saw it with The Last Dance. The Last Dance runs and half of Twitter was like, "Well, he was good, but,
this Jordan character feels like we should know about him."
And we were so offended, but bless their hearts, they didn't see him play. And so in this case, you have an entire generation, 20 years exactly, of sports fans who didn't see Dale Earnhardt race. But it wasn't just about 76 wins and 7 championships. It also was just about the presence in the room. always say with Dale Earnhardt, if there was 1,000 of us in a ballroom and we're all looking, you know, at a stage and he were to come in the back door when none of us were looking, we'd all instinctively just turn around because the air in the room changed. There was just a presence and a way that he carried himself and conducted his business. And the Intimidator thing, that was legit. Every time I knew him, and every time I was in a room with him, there was a little part of me that was just trying not to say something stupid or pass out.
So, like, on the back of the baseball card, Ryan, so to speak, what are the accomplishments that people should know about what Dale did?
Well, the 76 wins are a really big deal, but the 7 championships in, you know, 70 plus years of stock car racing, only 3 people have won 7 championships. His greatest success was on the super speedways, the Talladega Super Speedway and Daytona. He won 34 races at Daytona National Speedway. 34. Mm. Now, only one of those was the Daytona 500. And that was part of the appeal for him was, even though he was this one tough customer and the man in black and the Intimidator and all those things, it took him 20 tries to finally win the Daytona 500 and lost it in heartbreaking fashion multiple times.
20 years of trying, 20 years of frustration. Dale Earnhardt will win the Daytona 500.
That trophy right there, my name's on it now. They can't take it off. I don't care. I love it.
He was an everyman, but he also was Superman. And that was always the appeal.
And outside of that ballroom full of the sports power brokers, Ryan, what was his status like regionally among the NASCAR faithful? How would you begin to describe what he meant to those people?
Well, at first they hated him. Because when he came along in the late 1970s, and, you know, it wasn't disrespect, but he didn't back down from Richard Petty, from Cale Yarborough, from Bobby Allison, from David Pearson, you know, and he pissed them off. I mean, they couldn't stand him. And he would wreck them in a short track race in Martinsville. And afterwards, Richard Petty's lecturing him. Listen, kid, you can't do it like this. And he just kept doing it his way.
Dale Earnhardt would pass up friendship if it meant he'd be respected. He'd pass up respect if it meant he'd win.
Labonte takes the lead. Here comes Earnhardt. He hits Labonte. Labonte spins in turn 2.
I wasn't going to wreck him, but I got to him and he turned him around. So didn't mean to really turn around. Meant to rattle his cage over.
Earnhardt comes in. Yep. Taps him. And around he goes.
Anytime you get close to racing with Earnhardt, you're in trouble.
So how eventually did people come to love this guy?
Well, he wouldn't stop winning. And he also kind of embraced his persona. He loved the fact that, you know, when he switched to a black race car for GM Goodrich in the late 80s, he openly said, okay, I'll be Darth Vader. That's cool. Darth Vader's the coolest guy that anyone's ever seen. You might hate him, but at the end of the day, he's the greatest. And so he embraced that. And then toward the end of his life, I'll never forget, the last conversation I had with him was 2 days before he died. And on that Friday, him looking right at me and giving me a hard time. I'd taken a new job. He thought I was probably bitten off more than I could chew and giving me a hard time about it. But we talked about the fact that he was so happy. And Dale Earnhardt Jr. was having success in the Cup Series. And, you know, it was his third marriage and his third go around at being a father. He had a teenage daughter at the time and was loving fatherhood. And, you know, everything had fallen into place. He gave this famous interview to Darrell Waltrip that same day. And he said, I've got it all. And for the first time in his life, he was truly happy. And so to go from this angry, you know, didn't want to talk, would punch you in the face guy to the guy we saw at the end and who won races the whole way through, it was quite the metamorphosis. This is a guy who dropped out of school in the 8th grade and was embarrassed by that. But when he died, was worth almost $500 million. And so there's just people who are, in the words of Dale Jr., there's people who are just the guy. And Dale Earnhardt was the guy.
So Dale Earnhardt, Ryan, he was on top of the racing world. He was coming off this incredibly successful decade in the 90s where he wins four cup championships. But at the same time, NASCAR itself was in some ways fraught, specifically when it comes to safety. What was it like covering the sport at that time?
It was terrible. And it wasn't just NASCAR. I mean, listen, I covered IndyCar, I covered drag racing, I covered, you know, dirt track racing, and people were dying all the time. I mean, to the point that I remember after Tony Roper died.
I just got the word that Tony Roper passed away.
35-year-old Roper is the third man to die in NASCAR this year.
It just seems like almost on a regular basis now we're faced with situations like this.
And it was in October of 2000. And I saw everyone in the garage at Talladega getting ready for the Cup Series race. Could have cared less. And I came home and told my wife, I remember that night, I said, I'm done. I gotta figure out a way to cover another sport. I cannot cover another funeral. Adam Petty was 19 years old. Richard Petty's grandson had died that May. And Kenny Irwin Jr., who I had spent a lot of time with, was a young Cup Series racer. He died that summer, same track, New Hampshire Motor Speedway, where Adam Petty died. But everyone just kind of kept rolling with it. And I just couldn't believe it. I just remember thinking, why are we not fixing these things? Why are you racers not fixing this stuff? But they just were moving on to the next race.
So your film documents nine deaths throughout NASCAR in the 1990s and how seven of those deaths were attributed to the same kind of injury. What was that injury?
The fatal injury for all of those racers was what we call a basilar skull fracture. And what was happening was the racer is strapped with multiple point harnesses into the race seat, but the head is not restrained. And you're talking 12 pounds, you know, a human head with a helmet on it. And so when these racers would hit a bare concrete wall and the car would go from 180 miles an hour to zero, the head would continue to travel. And so a basilar skull fracture, what that means is the five bones that connect the skull to the top of the spinal cord are broken. The spine, the blood vessels, the breathing passages, everything is ripped apart. And so death comes instantaneously. And so that's the injury that was killing these guys. And so a head and neck restraint keeps your head restrained along with your body. It was relatively new technology, but it existed. And drivers didn't want to wear it because they weren't comfortable, and they didn't know what a basilar skull fracture was. We just said head injuries. That's all we said.
Bioengineer Dr. Robert Hubbard says when a car hits the wall at 170 miles per hour, the car stops. The restrained torso stops. But the head, which is not strapped in, snaps forward and back, unless the driver is wearing one of these, a one-pound collar and straps similar to roller coaster restraints, called HANS, short for head and neck system.
What did Earnhardt think of that new restraint, of that proposed safety measure?
Hated him. The Hans device was the primary head and neck restraint. You're taking a metal and carbon fiber neck brace, essentially, and it sits on the shoulders, and there are straps that connect that brace to the helmet. And he hated it because he thought it would keep him from using his legendary peripheral vision.
I'm comfortable that the cars are safe, and I'm safe in there, and everything's going to be okay. I don't ever think about seeing another guy wreck that I could be in the same situation.
And so there were safety ideas and theories that he liked. He loved the idea of soft walls, of an energy-absorbing barrier, but he hated the Hans device.
I've crashed a lot. People's crashed over the years and not got hurt, and people's crashed and lost their lives. Who's to say what's right and wrong? I don't know.
Coming up, the darkest day in NASCAR history serves as a wake-up call to an entire sport.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot, taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
Ryan, I want to turn to that fateful day, February 18th, 2001. Dale Earnhardt is racing in his 23rd Daytona 500, and his son, Dale Jr., was also in that race. What did Dale Jr. tell you about his memories of that day?
His openness, Pablo, was just unbelievable talking to me about this. And he and I have had a great relationship for a long time. But he doesn't remember a whole lot about the morning of the race. But what he does remember prior to the race is Dale Earnhardt Sr. typically would just walk straight to his race car. He'd wave at people, but he didn't sign autographs. He and his wife, Teresa, would just walk straight to the car. It's game mode. I mean, he's ready to go. But that race morning, on his way to his car, he went and found Dale Jr.
I kind of remember that morning on pit road. He came up and he was like, you know, hey, you can do this. We're going to do this together.
And he put his arm around him and he said, we've got race cars. Let's take care of them. If we work together today, we can do that. And Dale Jr. told me, he said, that was a dad moment. And he didn't have a lot of those. But for whatever reason, that particular day, Dale Earnhardt Sr. made sure to come by there and say something to him.
He didn't do that before races. I never saw him. You know, I'd be at my car getting in and he wouldn't come up to me, you know. The rest of the memories are all afterwards.
And now for the most famous words in motorsports.
Gentlemen, start your engine!
Ryan, you were there at that time. What were your own memories of that race and the events of that day?
Well, with any Daytona 500, and this year will be my 26th, part of the beauty of the event is the tension that builds throughout the race. The Daytona 500, because of the nature of the race and the nature of the racetrack, you are guaranteed to have drama. As the lap count goes down, 5 to go, 3 to go, 2 to go, 1 to go. And in that race, it was like that.
1 to go. The last lap. 1 to go, buddy.
And there was something that happened on that last lap that no one had ever seen before, which was that Dale Sr. went from racing for first and being his normal aggressive self to moving into a third place defensive position. Because the two cars that were running up front, Michael Waltrip and Dale Earnhardt Jr., were owned by Dale Earnhardt. That was his race team, Dale Earnhardt Incorporated. Wasn't the team he drove for, but that was the team that he owned. And so he started blocking his
play. Blocking. That up, boy.
Dale Earnhardt was running third. The field behind him had gotten very antsy, and they were doing everything they could to try to get around him. And it was just a bump. You know, Rubbin's racing. That's a cliche for a reason. Mm. And he was turned into the outside retaining wall in turn four.
Come on, big trouble. Big wreck behind him.
And my concern as an educated race fan was that when he hit the wall, there wasn't a lot to it. when his car hit the wall at the dreaded, we call it the 1 o'clock angle, at the, you know, the right front corner of the car, and it hit the wall, and there wasn't a lot of energy. Like, it just hit that wall with a thud.
How about Dale? Is he okay?
Schrader has climbed out of his car. He and Earnhardt crashed together at Liberty turns 3 and 4. Looking good.
I was worried immediately because that 1 o'clock angle, that's the deadly angle. That's the angle that killed Adam Petty, Kenny Irwin, Tony Roper, Neil Bonnett, Rodney Orr. I mean, I could go down the whole list. Everyone that had died the decade before that. And when his car just slid into the infield grass, and then the indicator was Kenny Schrader, who was in the crash with him, one of his best friends. When Kenny got out of his car and went to Dale Earnhardt's car and put the window net down, and the look on Kenny's face and the way that Kenny immediately turned to the emergency crews, like, please get over here. That's when I knew it was bad. I think that's when everyone knew it was bad.
So at this point, what's the scene like on the track, Ryan? What happens next?
The race ends, and everyone does a cool-down lap. So they all take the checkered flag across the start-finish line. They all take one more slow lap before they go into the garage. They all saw Dale Earnhardt's car sitting in the grass inside of turn 4 as they all came around. That included Dale Jr.
Well, in hot pursuit of Dale Earnhardt Jr., who is going out toward turn 4 to see if he can find out about his father.
And so Dale Earnhardt Jr.'s instinct was to get out of the car and run.
I just had a feeling that I knew something was wrong, and I went to the infield care center, and I walked by the room that Kenny Schrader was in, and we locked eyeballs, and I knew in the way Kenny looked at me. I mean, I didn't stop and look at him. I was just walking by the room, and I saw him, and I looked and looked to where I was going, but I thought, that look on his face, it was a good look.
As soon as they made eye contact, Dale Jr. knew, I have to leave here and go to the hospital. And at that point, Dale Earnhardt, his father, was already being taken to Halifax Medical Center, which is only a mile away from the racetrack.
The moment after we got in there, literally the emergency room is just inside the door. Like, you just walk in and you're there. And they had gave up. When I realized that dad was gone, there's noise coming out of me that I can't recreate. I couldn't do it for you right now. It's just like a bellow of shock and sorrow and fear. I went back in my bus in my room and shut the door and to my bedroom and just sat there. And I thought to myself in that very moment, I was like, I'm gonna have to do this by myself. I'm gonna, you know, the rest of my life. Having dad was like a cheat sheet. Having dad was like knowing all the answers to everything. And I was like, man, I'm gonna have to do this without that the rest of my life.
The official word didn't come until a couple of hours later.
This is undoubtedly one of the toughest announcements that I've ever personally had to make.
It's the most infamous four words in the history of motorsports.
After the accident in turn 4 at the end of the Daytona 500, we've lost Dale Earnhardt.
We've lost Dale Earnhardt. Spoken by Mike Helton, the NASCAR president. And he had already known at that point for almost 2 hours. They just had to figure out how they were going to say this.
Drivers used to say the worst thing to see on the track was Dale Earnhardt in your rearview mirror. Now we all realize the worst thing is not to see Dale Earnhardt at all.
In the wake of Dale's death, Ryan, we saw grief and sadness overtake the sport. We saw seemingly never-ending tributes to him. And we saw this growing sense that NASCAR could not let this happen again, especially after it was confirmed that Dale had succumbed to that same basal skull fracture. Do you remember when and how you started to notice that the response to Dale's death was going to be something more than just grief?
Yeah, it was the next weekend. The very next weekend, the next race was scheduled at my hometown track in Rockingham, North Carolina, the North Carolina Motor Speedway. And being in that garage when it opened on Friday for practice, the Friday after Dale Earnhardt died on Sunday, to go into the garage. And what I noticed immediately was it was like a science fair.
In the garage area this week, I've seen more people looking at seats, seat belts, restraint systems than I have ever seen before.
What if we take this webbing and we put this next to your head? Or what if we extend this armrest on your seat to where it will rise up and be your head will be up against that if you have a right front impact? All of these drivers who refuse to use any sort of head and neck restraint, extra webbing in the car, using a different seat with a different headrest, all of a sudden, every car, I swear, had something I'd never seen before in it. The inventors of the Hans device, the head and neck restraint, they sold less than 300 from 1991 through February 18th, 2001. The week after Dale Earnhardt's death, they sold more than that. In a week, no one in the garage was going to wait on a mandate. No one in the garage was going to wait on NASCAR to say, you have to do this, which is typically how that worked. Instead, they all were taking it into their own hands, literally. And that continued throughout the summer until NASCAR finally mandated head and neck restraints in October 2001.
So at this moment in time, Ryan, it seems like the people who had been most opposed to those changes were the drivers themselves. How exactly did this particular event do so much to change their minds on this?
Well, Dale Earnhardt Jr. was really eloquent about this.
When it was just another driver, it was easy for the driver group to go, hey, that's part of racing. But when it was the man, you went, dang, it can happen to him, it can happen to me.
What it became is it was kind of a freak accident. That's how this guy died. Or it became, Adam Petty was only 19. He wasn't experienced. Or Kenny Earl Jr. was always kind of reckless. And, Tony Roper, that was a weird way he got turned into the wall. You kind of figured out a way to reason through it. But when Superman died, all of a sudden you have a group of individuals and race car drivers who are having to grapple with something that they really do not like to ever face, and that's vulnerability. If the superhuman dies, then the human has no chance. And that's what happened.
You mentioned the adoption of the head and neck restraint. What other key safety measures did NASCAR introduce after Dale's death?
Safer barriers, soft walls. We call it energy-absorbing walls that could be bolted to, at the time, the current concrete walls. That was the second big step. And the third big step was within the race car itself. As these cars were getting faster, they were becoming more rigid, the way they were built. And the greenhouse, they call it, around the race car driver had gotten tighter. There wasn't much space for them to move around. And so that changed. By the middle of the 2000s, that greenhouse area had become a box, a reinforced steel box. And the drivers were moved more toward the center of the car to try to give them a fighting chance, if they had a left side impact. And so all of that was set into motion on February 18th, 2001. Kyle Petty said it to me. He said, in the first 50 plus years of the sport, if you're looking at a yardstick, NASCAR's safety improvement took up about 1 inch of that yardstick over the first 50 years. And over the last 20 years, it's taken up the rest of that measuring stick.
Up next, NASCAR's safety improvements are put to the test.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
So, Ryan, I wanted to bring us full circle here back to what you discussed at the very beginning of our show. Last year's Daytona 500 and Ryan Newman's crash, because in some ways, it was eerily, almost cosmically similar to the crash that took Dale Earnhardt. It was the same race, the same lap. And for a while afterwards, I know everyone watching thought it would have the same outcome. But it didn't.
Ryan Newman walked out of a Florida hospital today, just under 48 hours after millions of viewers had pronounced him dead. Newman was the beneficiary of the safety upgrades that came after Dale Sr. died on the same track in the year 2001.
What did those safety improvements, the ones spurred by the death of Dale Earnhardt, what did they do for Ryan Newman?
You know, I've watched that crash so many times now. I've watched it with Ryan Newman. And you know, what he says, he still has the car. He has the car in a barn on his property in North Carolina.
I've got the car. I've got my helmet. I feel like that race car is a trophy of something that saved my life.
And I asked him, what does he see when he looks at that car? And he said, I see every person, every engineer, every race car driver who contributed to all of the things that added up to save my life.
It's a credit to all the people in the industry, not just this year, not just the people that built that race car, but the last 100 years of building race cars and technology. Those people collectively saved my life.
And when I watched that crash, it is this almost eerily perfect illustration of the evolution of a NASCAR stock car since Dale Earnhardt's death. I mean, he hit with a right side impact, but he hit a safer barrier, a soft wall. He had a super strong head whip with all the G forces. Well, that head whip was minimized by a head and neck restraint. When he ended up upside down on the racetrack twice and was driven through by another race car, the custom seat fit it only to his body that he was in. That tub is what saved his life. The brand new tech helmet that he was wearing. I mean, all of those things added up. There was a Newman bar that had been added to those race cars several years ago per Ryan Newman's suggestion after an upside down on his roof crash he'd had at Talladega, actually three of them in the course of a couple of years. So all of those things added up to save him. And he knows that, but he also adds there had to have been an angel involved in there too, because as a Purdue-educated engineer, he still can't add it all up and make it work.
So when you add up all the math, Ryan, since Dale died, how many deaths have there been in NASCAR?
Zero. Zero. Zero deaths across NASCAR's top three national series since February 18, 2001. And no one is naive enough to believe that there's not ever going to be another fatality in a NASCAR stock car. But the challenge now is to make sure that while no one is dying, that you don't get complacent. And I think that Ryan Newman's crash ultimately, I'm telling you, standing in victory lane that night. And looking around at everyone, and realizing there were only a handful of us. I mean, a couple of hundred people in that victory lane. And there were only a handful of us that knew that feeling and that had the muscle memory of, okay, this is what we have to do if Ryan Newman's dead. That's a gift. But it also was a reminder to the people who have never experienced that, you know, racing is safer, but it's never going to be safe.
So, Ryan, this streak that NASCAR is now on with zero deaths since Dale passed away, I'm curious about this idea that actually some people are now wondering if NASCAR had gotten too safe.
Yeah.
How are people feeling about it now? How are you feeling about that now?
Yeah, I haven't heard anything out of them since Ron Newman's crash. You know, we used to hear that all the time. And then when those same people who clearly weren't around when I was around in the 90s, when it was just funeral after funeral after funeral, after everyone stood there silently in the grandstand at Daytona and outside that hospital that night, and I got friends calling, going, I can't believe what I just saw. He just died. I haven't heard anything out of those folks because they got a little taste of it, a little taste of how awful it can be. You know, there's a great Springsteen quote, you know, it was in his book, Born to Run. And the quote was, he said, he likes his gods old and grizzled and here. And he said, the exit in a blaze of glory is bull. And that's how I feel. You might think it's romantic to be racing out there with concussions and broken bones and your eyelids taped open and death. But I was there and I saw it, and there wasn't a damn thing romantic about it.
You can check out Ryan McGee's new E60 film, Intimidator, The Lasting Legacy of Dale Earnhardt, which airs this Sunday at noon Eastern on ESPN. I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. Our show is produced by Alexander Hyacinth, Mike Johns, Steve Martin, Ryan Nantel, Andy Tennant, Eve Tro, Chris Tuminello, and Aaron Vail. Special thanks this week to Sinia Blue, Andres Soto, Tom Howard, Scott Sikowski, Jason Costura, Max Brodsky, Troy Farkas, and Jackson Ugelo. I'll talk to you Monday.